So how are you doing this morning? Everyone's doing well? After a fashion?
Good, okay. This is planet Earth calling Mount Hermon.
Okay, so we've, over this weekend, you've been very kind and indulgent with me as we've covered a lot of ground. And you might recall the first really meaty session was yesterday morning, actually. It seems like a long time ago. But we were talking about the nature of truth. And one of the things I think we have to do as Christians is we have a major task ahead of us, I think, to use the language of Paul, to tear down a certain stronghold, and that is that human beings in and of themselves are capable of understanding what it means to be human. And I talked about some of the major problems there have been our trust in philosophy, our trust in science, and you don't have to be a Christian to realize that that's highly problematic. In fact, you might recall one of the people I spoke about was a Marxist by the name of Benedetto Croce, and he argued that all we actually have is history. Everything we know comes to us from our experience. And because we're finite creatures, that's deeply troubling. And so humanity has spent, probably at least in the Western tradition, the last 2,500 years trying to find a way to escape from our finitude so we can establish some kind of foundation on the basis of human reason. And it just doesn't work. So you sang in the hymn this morning, we are what? Frail creatures of dust and feeble as frail. This is the truth. And I talked to Brother John. He will certainly inform you of this matter. And in fact, he incarnates this as you watch him hobble across from breakfast today. But, lest you get proud beyond all measure, we are your destiny. Look on us and despair. Yeah. Right. So I think, you know, this is it's one of the really important things for human beings to learn. We just get so self-confident when things are going okay, but we are so fragile. It doesn't take a lot to diminish us. So we fly down the highway in our wonderful chrome and silver machines and we feel like lords of the earth, but all you have to do is hit a lamppost and you soon discover just how fragile we are in all kinds of ways. And I try to suggest that by the 3rd century AD, the Greco-Roman world knew that. Philosophy had collapsed, but into the middle of that came this story of John, right? And he's doing history. And his claim is that we worship a God like no other. Now, no one's actually asked me about this piece of graffiti. Anyone familiar with this? Well, it says, Alexandros worships his God. And this is Alexandros here. And he's a figure on a cross with an ass's head. And any guesses as to who that might be referring? Well, it's a piece of anti-Christian graffiti. Because that's how absurd this message appeared in the ancient world. It was so countercultural and so not what people were expecting. Sorry, thanks for the knee. I just need to see my video there. What I try to suggest was, first of all, the nature of truth is largely historical. And last night we talked about the role of rhetoric shaping the future. It's a different kind of thing. And I also try to argue that what you've got in Jesus is actually God's rhetoric, which means that in Jesus, you have God's transforming word about a different kind of future. And in the Roman world, we don't have time to go into it, but the Roman world had this wonderful propaganda machine going where they were telling people, we are as good as it will ever get. We're going to bump up against a little bit of that in a few moments when we start talking about glory. But if you know something of what the Roman world was like, it was a pretty grim situation unless you're amongst the few elite. And something changed that. And the answer was, it is the story of Jesus. It wasn't a selfish gene, as we talked about. It wasn't philosophy. It was the story of Jesus. If Christ died, Paul says he died for all. And if he died for all, that means everybody is of equal value, regardless of your gender, regardless of your social status, regardless of your race. And they are probably the most radical words found in the New Testament and 200 or 300 years on either side of that statement. It is simply astonishing. We don't have time to go into all of that, but just the impact of Christianity on the ancient world is unbelievable. And even people like Richard Dawkins, it seems to me, without realizing it, assumes so much of the Christian impact on the world. So when he complains about the way Christians have treated people, he only really does that because he's assuming Christian values. Because nobody in the ancient world would ever have made that complaint. It's the irony of it all. He carries on like this. You think, mate, you don't realize how Christian you are, even as you make your critique. So this story, we talk about what is truth, and then we talk about what is holiness. And I try to suggest if holiness... holiness must be related to who this God is and what he wants. It's a different kind of God. If this God is life and the only way it has life and he wants to give us life, I want to suggest to you that perhaps holiness is fundamentally characterized by life. That's a major change for me. I thought holiness was characterized by some kind of moral goodness. And then you went up setting morality over against life, or even God gets set over against morality. And that's a real mistake, I think. Now, of course, some of you might ask then, well, what about moral issues? Well, we're always worried about, what about naughtiness? Right? I've got to deal with this somehow. Well, yes, God is concerned with how we live. There's no doubt about that. But if the truth is personal, and if God is characterized by life, and therefore so is holiness, then we're always going to deal with moral issues in ways that respect the person and bring life to others. That's the way you ought to come at moral issues. The Greeks separate ethics from their gods because they can't trust their gods. We talked about the poets who begin to criticize the kind of activities that Homer attributes to the gods. So what happens in the Greek tradition is human beings become the locus of thinking about virtue, and it becomes an intellectual exercise. I really don't like the word ethics for that reason. I'd much rather talk about character. You talk about character, it's a much more personal term. And what you keep coming up against in the Bible is the character of God who is good to all and has compassion on all that he has made. This is life-giving stuff. So how can this help us, for example? Well, if you've ever been involved in any kind of pastoring, you'll know very quickly that there are some situations where you have only two choices, bad and worse. That's all you've got. If your framework is simply good and bad, you're stuffed. You don't really have anything to say in that situation, and when you do, you come across as being inhumane, uncaring, arrogant, and self-righteous. Because you've set yourself up for that. But if you've understood that God is about life, you can, in all good conscience, counsel a person to make the bad choice and not the worse one, because you're moving them toward life. They might be neck deep in rubbish. If you get them to waist deep, you're heading in the right direction. Right? Because you're about life and you're about moving people toward that. Right? I think that's going to make Christians sound a lot more humane and loving, right? Because we're on about life. And we have lots of difficult decisions like that. Many of you know about that, right? What do you do in a world where just about everything you do and touch is somehow involved in the impression of somebody else? You can't live with that if everything is about ultimately having to be perfectly good. But if it's a matter of somehow moving toward life, then that gives you some kind of framework to make decisions, it seems to me. Right. Well, that would be the moral question for me. How does one deal with that? You want to respect a person and move in directions toward life. So it's a matter of emphasis. I think too many of us, in spite of all our talk about God, the most important thing in our life is actually sin. Right? Because that's the thing we give the most weight. Right? You're living a Christian life and something goes wrong and suddenly the sin thing becomes the most dominant thing in the world. You make a mistake, you sin, and now that just clouds everything. As though Jesus' death means nothing. Now, I think when Paul says that we are free from the power of sin, he means exactly what he says. And that doesn't mean we won't ever sin. And this is going to be hard to hear. It means it no longer has any consequences for us. and you can just hear the chorus of voices again. But what about naughtiness? Okay. But it's really important you understand that. Some of us give far too much power to sin. It becomes the thing that defines us. And our life is lived, not in terms of life, but how long the gaps are between moments of sinning, right? That's the thing. We kind of keep record, and it's not so much focusing on the riches of the life you live, but all the times you fall over, they become the dominant things. Well, why do you think Paul gets accused of preaching, you know, oh, well, Paul, your message is let's sin more so that grace might abound. Why do you think they accuse him of doing that? I think because he says very seriously, given that Christ has died, sin has no power over you. It really doesn't. So the metaphor I like to use is somebody learning to skateboard or snowboard, which I tried to do a few times, and it was rather spectacular. I remember coming down the hill once and having an amazing wipeout at the feet of these young people, and this young woman turns around and says, "That was amazing." Dust myself off. Yeah, I've been practicing that one. Right? All day, in fact. But you know what? What if the thing that really excites God is not how often you fall over, but the fact that this time, you know, you actually took a few more steps in the right direction? What if he's just really encouraging about that? And I've shared this story many times. That, you know, I have two kids, and when my son first began to walk, and, you know, if you're a parent, you'll know about that, the first great step, right? So, you know, little Steve's crawling around his hands and knees, and then he approaches the coffee table with this look of intent, right? And suddenly mum and dad's conversation ceases and we watch. And he's not aware of any of this, right? He's just approaching the table, little hands get up there and right, chubby little legs and they're kind of wobbling like this, you know, poking out through the diaper and right? And he turns around with this big grin, okay, and he lifts his hands off and plonk, down he goes and we pick him up and kick him out of the house straight away. Right? It's kind of a silly image, but, you know, honestly, think about it. How many of you think that that's what God does to you whenever you fail? Seriously, I mean deep down in your gut, when you're alone and you've done something you're really ashamed of and you deeply regret and you can never change, how many of you run home to that view of God? Seriously. Right. Well, you've got to let that go. And we're going to talk about the glory of our God today and why you have to let that view go if you're going to honor the God who gives you life. You have to stop telling yourself lies about God. Stop dishonoring him. Stop insulting him. He's not that kind of God. Right? And the amazing thing is this. Realizing that sin in the end has no power over you, ironically, does not lead to license. It actually leads to freedom. Because the pressure's off. Right? I think I might have said this the last time I was here, but it's worth saying again. I was in Brazil a number of years ago, and there's a huge game of soccer going on between two big competitive teams in Brazil. I mean, it's Brazil, right? The soccer kings of the world. So everyone's into this. These guys are getting paid huge amounts of money. The game ends up being tied at full time, then some extra time, still tied. So now it's a penalty shootout, right? In fact, some of you might have seen this. Do you remember the European Cup some years ago when Manchester United were playing Chelsea? You remember that, right? And then it's a penalty shootout, right? And what does Ronaldo do? He missed, right? And I stick my hand up and say, you're paying him £20 million to do that. I'll do it for half as much. I can miss too, right? I mean, this guy, every day of the week, blindfolded, can put a ball in from, 500 metres on a windy night with snow, and he can just do that, right? Why did he miss? What's the answer? Pressure. Sin no longer has power over you. The pressure's off, and you'll be amazed how much freedom that gives you in actually starting to live the life of God because the pressure's off. And people don't understand that. That's Paul's gospel, okay? So this is not what defines you. This is. It's no longer you who lives, but Christ in you. Right? It's his life that's at work in you. So just like my son keeps wanting to approach that coffee table, and even when he falls on his butt, he gets up again and has another shot at it, that's what's happening in you every day as the Spirit of God moves you toward the divine coffee table. Right? And, you know, you fall down on your butt and those little legs want to get up and have another shot at it, and you think, how is this? My son doesn't even think about it. He's just going in that direction. Why? Because it's in him, and God has put his Spirit within you. He's going to take care of that. As long as you don't get in the way by putting the emphasis on the wrong thing. If he kept on focusing on how many times he fell over, he would never walk. Right? So here's a word, get over yourself, okay? It's not actually about you. It's about the life of Christ in you. And when you finally get over yourself, you'll find you start bringing the life of God to other people. Because it's not about you anymore, right? It's about them. And that changes everything. And I don't think it's heresy. I really don't. So, if you read through John's gospel, yes, John knows about sin. He knows about judgment. He's not ignoring those things. But over and over and over again, the emphasis lies on eternal life, massively. And who's saying this? This is the guy who is Jesus' official biographer and interpreter. Right? He hardly mentions the kingdom of God, but he is just obsessive about eternal life. That's what we're about. Eh? So we're not called to be the moral police of the universe. We're rather to hold out and embody God's offer of his life to the world. And that's pretty cool. I can do that. Thinking about this stuff has changed my life. You know, I'm actually pleased to be a Christian. I haven't always felt like that, to be honest. I mean, I would give the pious answer, but, you know, kind of deep down inside, well, I'm not so sure about this. But now, this is great. I'm really happy to be a Christian. It's a good thing. Well, this is going to bring us to our last little chat today, and this is, what is the nature of glory? Yes, that's how they really looked in the ancient world. You might think they look garish. But the statues you see today have had all the paint worn off them. The Romans loved very colourful things. And here is a famous statue of Caesar, Augustus Caesar, found in Prima Porta. And if you take New Testament Foundations with me at one point at Regent College, we have a section where I just take people through his breastplate and talk about what Cupid's doing here. And just this is an incredible imperial ideology. He's just wearing this stuff that's basically about the power and grandeur and glory of Rome, right, as the ultimate expression of the God's will upon the earth. And this guy walks around, you know, and you think Augustus has an ego? You don't even know the meaning of ego. Right? So what is glory? Well, because I am given to the reality of history, I can't talk about this stuff without talking about history. Just can't, right? I've got to pay attention to the culture. I've got to pay attention to the setting. I am deeply historical. I just can't get away from that. So if we're going to talk about glory in the first century, we better know what that word meant to people in the Greco-Roman world. And there he is again, Mr. Pitt. Right? This is, of course, from the Iliad. And you know Achilles, there's a wonderful story where Achilles gets his armor and it never quite works in the movie. There's some things in Homer you just can't put on screen because it loses its luminosity. But he gets this shield and, you know, he's just kind of shining with glory and splendor. This is part of the Homeric tradition. The great warrior, arete, excellence. And of course, in the Greek world, it didn't help very much because the cities kept on fighting one another. There's all kinds of bloodshed. They treated each other horribly. There's a problem with that kind of glory, it seems to me. It begins to shift into the 3rd, 2nd and 1st century to wisdom, being a wise one and hence reputation. That's what the word doxa can mean, by the way. So the word glory, doxa, it's the Greek word in the New Testament, it can also mean reputation. Right? That's your glory. What are you known for? That's your glory. Right? Comes to the Hebrew also has a similar idea. Kavod means kind of weight, weighty, right? Are you a weighty person? You know the story in Daniel where the finger writes on the wall, many, many tickle a pause and write. It's basically saying that, you know, Belshazzar is a powder puff, right? I mean, this guy is souffle. There's no substance about him. And that's important in the ancient world. Do you have some substance? Are you a person of some weight, some gravitas, some glory? Or are you just a trivial person that floats through life like naval lint? Right? What are you? Right? Really important. So, you know, reputation, glory. And you see some people like this. They walk around and, you know, they just exude this gravitas, right? And they kind of learn how to sometimes even to put that on, right? Just the way they move themselves. And, I'll leave that one. I was going to say something, but we're Christians and I won't. It can also mean common opinion. Isn't that interesting? Right? And it means this in the rhetorical world. Endoxa means common opinion, right? So doxa can mean shining appearance. It can mean reputation, and they're linked because it's how you appear to people, right? That is your reputation. And then endoxa is the common opinion that people hold. So John talks a lot about glory. If you want to understand that term, it's not just that Jesus walks around with a whole array of neon lights up his robe, so he kind of, you know, right? It's not that. It has a great history, and it's all related to human frailty. Remember that scene in The Gladiator when they're about to charge on the Gauls in that opening battle scene? Okay. What we do today will live on in what? Eternity, right? And off they go, right? That's the great longing. You see, we are designed for eternity. We weren't designed to die. And that's the thing that just goes against the grain. That's why we do this philosophy stuff. That's why we do all these great deeds. We're seeking some kind of immortality. Isn't it interesting? The Bible knows all about that. And God's offering us that. He knows we were made for this. He says, I want to give you life. You were made for it. You were made for my life to indwell you. You were made to join in the life of the Trinity. That's what it's here for. That's what I'm offering you. What's to lose? And some people still say no. But that's what they're after here. So, splendor, appearance, your reputation, and then common opinion as to how things are. This is, I think, Kurete Street in Ephesus. Right? Obviously not from that period, as you can tell from the style of dress. Not too many robes there. Right? I just had my TARDIS the other day and went back and took that shot. Well, just to put this in context now, for many people in the ancient world, the universe was two-tiered. It's the perfect spiritual realm above, and then there's the broken, chaotic physical world in which we lived. Right? So we have the... If you look at Greek statues, it's amazing how unrealistic most of them are. You notice that? I was in Cairo Museum just this summer, and I'd never actually seen some of this Egyptian... I'd seen the Egyptian temple paintings, but I'd never seen the more common sculptures of the non-aristocrats. They are amazingly lifelike. I saw a carving of a scribe, I think from about 3000 BC, it was simply astonishing in terms of the way the sculptor had picked up the emotion in the face of this scribe. It is absolutely incredible. I was speechless. I'd never realized that was there. Right? But you don't get that in the Greeks. Right? Everything's perfectly proportioned. Why do they do that? Because they're living in this two-tiered universe. They're seeking for perfection. They know the world is broken. You've got to get out of it somehow. That shapes the way they think about things. Right now, so what does that say about God? Well, here's what they think about God. God is incorporeal, meaning he doesn't have a body. Why does he not have a body? Because anything that's in the physical world is going to change, and if it's changing, it can't be true or perfect, right? Remember that? Parmenides, if it's true, it has to be the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow, right? And Heraclitus says, well, look in the mirror lately, buddy. Right? Everything changes. So anything that's embodied is automatically problematic for the Greeks from this perspective. Okay? And, you know, that's what so many of you are labouring under. And our fashion industry is terribly culpable in this. Have you ever seen the Dove ads about real beauty? Heard of those? Anyone seen them? Okay, they're great, right? Your daughters have got to see this. We have to resist this with all that's within us. It is so, so destructive. It doesn't bring wholeness. So, incorporeal, one, immeasurable, begetter of everything, blessed and beneficent, the best, in lack of nothing himself, bearing all things, celestial, ineffable, unnameable, and as he himself says, invisible, unconquerable, whose nature is difficult to find, and if found, cannot be expressed among the many. Now, you want to be really careful, because a lot of this language has crept into Christian talk about God. And I wonder how much of that is actually Christian. Difficult to find. Seeking after God because he's hard to find. You read your Gospels, have you? And you had a conversation about this week at Regent. And a couple of us in this conversation, and one person was saying, someone was asking us, well, just, what kind of characterizes your life? And this one person said, well, I'm just searching after God. I want to find him. And it was just from deep within. And I listened to this, and because of a certain time frame, this person had to go, and then I was asked the question. And I said, to be honest, I don't even think in those terms. I'm not trying to find God. He found me. I don't feel I'm on a search for God. I feel like he's embraced me with this incredible love and he holds me in his grace and mercy. What's to be found? I was the one who was lost. I mean, it sounds trivial to say that, but have you ever heard that? I think I might have mentioned this the other night, have you found Jesus? And the person responded, well, I didn't know he was lost, right? But that kind of sounds a bit, but let's think about this. Where do we get the notion that God is this hard, difficult thing to find? Given who Jesus is, right? Where does that come from? And notice this, and if found, cannot be expressed among the many. That's the Greek view. So here's this perfect deity, right, in a sphere, because that's going to, right, whatever. And here's the bulk of people all going, what's going on here? Right? And only if you're amongst the real elite will you ever have a chance to find God. Right? Now, you see what happens when Augustine picks up on some of this stuff, and it makes its way to the medieval church. That's why you have multi-leveled hierarchies of holiness, where special elite people get to find God and the rest of us kind of muddle around at the bottom. And where does that idea come from? I don't see that in the Bible. That's just what's coming out of the Greek world. Well, you start talking about an oriental God in terms of Greek categories, probably right to put it that way. There's a Freudian slip, right? And guess what you're going to end up with? There's a concept called appropriateness. You have to use the language appropriate to what it is you're talking about. I was in China recently, as I mentioned to you, teaching at universities. And there's a shift in China, as I alluded to on the first night, right? There's a sense amongst a number of elite people and businessmen in China that they have now surpassed the West. Right? Now, you might know this. About 500 years ago, as a Portuguese, I think he was a Jesuit, called Matteo Ricci, who came to China and wanted to get to know the Chinese and share the gospel with them. And so, the Jesuits were the educators of all Europe, so he was a very intelligent man, knew all kinds of things about astronomy, mathematics, etc. And he wrote a letter. He actually dressed in, adapted to Chinese ways and took on Chinese cultural habits, and people really appreciated that. He wasn't superior. He just related to them as genuine human beings. Many of them really liked him. He wrote a letter to the emperor, right? Long letter, very polite. I'd like to meet with you. And in the middle, he has this little line, I think I have something of interest for you. The letter never went beyond a middle-level bureaucrat. Why? Because of that one line. It implied that China had something to learn from another nation. Never went beyond that. And he didn't know what was going on for years, right? Until finally, as he got to know people better, one of the bureaucrats said, you need to change that line. And he did. Something to the effect of, I know I have nothing of interest for you, but I'd like to meet you. And he was in there, right? So he went in and he took with him some maps, right? And the Chinese had never seen maps like this, where there's this whole European thing out there. Up until that point, they thought they constituted 90% of the world. right at the very center. They were the Middle Kingdom. Everything used to surround the outside, right? Now, you understand it's the longest unbroken culture in human civilization. You can understand people being proud about that. That makes sense, right? But it sent shockwaves through the imperial court. And then this guy began to talk about astronomy, and it was just horrifying. Right? Now, I'm telling you this because that's what I hear from Chinese people today. And the Olympics was for them the turning point. They have finally broken free from Western domination. And now they're ready to start occupying their place in the center stage. Right? And when the guys start talking, their faces would light up and they're just, you know, they're going to do this now. Right? And of course, the opium wars, the horrible thing the Europeans did to them when we actually forced them to take our drugs at gunpoint. Right? That memory is not far below the surface. One of the great moments was being in China when one of my colleagues presented a paper on this, and he talked about the son of Wilberforce standing up in the English Parliament and for 3 hours berating the English government for what it was doing to China and saying, God will judge you for doing this. Right? And when this was explained to these Chinese scholars, they were just kind of astonished. As much as Chinese scholars reveal their astonishment, they don't tend to do much of that, but you know, you discover after something like that's going on. Now, part of the outcome of this is it's changing the way they see Christianity. One of the reasons Christianity was attractive because it had so much to offer, right? But now, not so much. And especially with the economic collapse in the West, right? So now when I go to China, the interest in Christianity is not the same because it's seen as Western, right? That's what made it attractive in the first place. It was Western, the path to technological development, path to modernization. They're there now. They're surpassing the West. We're not really sure about Christianity. We need to find something deep in Chinese culture. We have to go back to our roots. Right? And they need to do that in a hurry because a lot of the people I spoke to said China is in serious ethical crisis. I'm not going to say that too loudly, but in private conversation, the 6 or 7 people that I spoke to in different places, Beijing, Jinan, Shanghai, all said the same thing. You know, the serious problem facing China is one of ethics. Right? And they're trying to find some place to ground this. Where's all this leading? Well, I'm talking to them about the New Testament, and I get very intelligent Chinese students doing PhDs say to me, but hang on a minute, Christianity is Western. I say, no, it's not. Christianity is not a culture, it's a story. Right? It's got to have cultural elements because you can't tell a story without that. But what made Christianity different was you could be a Roman and a Christian. You could be Jewish and a Christian. You could be Greek and a Christian. It wasn't a culture. It was a story. No? You didn't have to change your culture to be Christian, though we often make that mistake and suggest to people that's exactly what you do have to do. Right? Look at how monocultural our churches are. It's got to tell you something about what we really believe in spite of all the talk. Right? So these guys are coming back to, well, we're not sure about that. Well, why aren't you? Well, if you reckon Christianity is not Western, how come whenever I pick up a systematic theology textbook, it's all Greek philosophy? Ba-dong. I'm trying to tell them this is an Oriental story. But the way we've talked about God, probably because we're Western for the last 2,000 years, has been inherently Western. And I think we've confused that with the God that we're really talking about. But you impose too many of those Western categories and you end up with something like this. That's one of the reasons I'm a little bit on the warpath over this and probably exaggerating things and not being as balanced as I should be. But this is a missional issue for me. Major missional issue. We have to learn to talk about God, getting back to those stories, and we've got to avoid talking about him in culturally bound ways. Conceptual systems. Watch that. Well, they're gods. What are the gods' glory like? We talked about this last night. Powerful, wise, vindictive, vengeful, capricious. Right. So that's what they think the glory of the gods are. What about people? The ideal, perfect man. Notice that no women. That's intentional. Women are not really human anyway. Right? The two up and down, and they behave in all kinds of weird ways. You know, They're kind of the other in Greek culture. Right? The women you're not sure about. You've got to kind of, right? Men, actually, right? These are the ones who can be truly human. So that's what, there is that sense, right? When you have the use of anthropos, you think, oh, no, that's just kind of generic term. Not so much. Right? Anthropos is the Greek word for man, right? No, they really do think that men are the ones who can do this. So, know therefore, Serenus, that this perfect man, full of virtues, human and divine, can lose nothing. This is what it means to be a glorious man in the ancient world, right? And here he is, kind of a schematic form, and he's sitting in his little hot tub, not quite. This is his cooler, right? And here's, at least that's what Australians think when they see this. The walls which guard the wise man, are safe both from flame and assault. They provide no means of entrance. They are lofty, impregnable, and godlike. That's their view of God. Lofty and impregnable. You see, if the world's a broken, messy place, all you can do is protect yourself from it, and that's why you study philosophy. To wall yourself off from the brokenness around you, philosophy becomes a form of therapy. Right? Now, as you become a great one like this, you know, and because you can focus on the divine, and you can do that because you're elite and have money for an education, the rest of the people like you, so the great Rick Watts, PhD from Cambridge University, by the way, and we only recognise Oxford and Bologna, so I don't know what this Berkeley business is, you've ever heard of that, right? Some funny little upstart place, goodness gracious me. Right? No. So here I am, one of the elite. Right? I can understand the divine things, but the rest of you, what do you know? You just live in California, right? Now, I'm just, you know, ordained to be here, but I'm not going to take you that seriously. Okay? I'll walk through life with gravitas, and I become a great one. Right? And I'm wealthy, so I give money, and it's all in my own honour. Right? So I'll have a pavement built, and the people will like me, I'll get special seats at the games, I'll even get an inscription. So the city of Cupertino offers this inscription, honouring the great Rick. Since Rick is a very noble and ancestral stock, having contributed all goodwill towards his country, being amicable to the citizens and in concord with his wife Katie, it is resolved that Theophilus be honoured with a painted portrait and a gold bust and a marble statue. Next time I come, lads. I expect to see this. Right? And that this decree is to be read aloud so that all may know. Right? There he is. Here's the statue, just in the right pose. Right? You notice how none of these statues have hair on their chests? And these are Greeks. Right? Because the gods don't have body hair. And you shave your body hair off to appear godlike. So the statues reflect that, right? Okay. So you get, this is what glory means for them. Now, how do you get into this glory? Well, ambition is what it's all about. Ambition is actually a virtue in the ancient world. Right? We call it climbing the greasy pole. That's part of our culture too, right? Get as much money as you can, keep working up the ladder. Right? China is besotted by that. It's about the only value that people have there as a culture. Just get up the ladder, make as much money as you can. Don't hear that. That's not me. I'm just reporting what people tell me. When I chat to people in China, that's one of the reasons why they think there's this enormous ethical problem going on. Even students who are involved in the Tiananmen Square protest, 20 years later, have said, you know what, there's tons of money to be made. Don't worry about that. Just get in there and make money. An actual conversation. Now, it's no different from us, right? I just mentioned that because China's becoming such a powerful player, right? We need to hear this. They need to hear it. We're all into this in various ways. So they have a little social checklist. Know yourself. This is not a journey to self-discovery by staring at your navel. Not about, or certainly not your neighbours, as we mentioned last night, right? This is to do with know your limitations. If you're going to have honour, don't ever get involved in something where you're going to fall short and appear a fool. Don't ever do that. Right? Make sure you know who you are so you can control every situation. Don't do anything to excess that will not enhance your glory or your reputation. Right? And the modern term for that is be cool. Right? Always measure the cost of something and the commitment. Is this worth doing? Right. Should I be your friend? So I'm going to watch this. I come on in and I look around the room and I try to work out who are the powerful people. Right? Once I've got them sorted out, I know the friendships that matter. I also know the also-rans that are not worth the time of day. Right? And the more powerful a friend can be, the more I'm willing to pay in order to have that kind of relationship. Right? Hit it again. Pick your time. Be thoughtful. Plan your move. Don't just shoot your mouth off. Wait for the right moment when you can stand up and offer that sage pearl of wisdom. And everyone will go, strike. Isn't Rick a clever bloke? Man, he's wise. There are 254 such sayings in the deluxe version. How to get ahead. So the whole thing is about climbing up the ladder. Right? The better a man is, the more he deserves, so that he who deserves most is the best. We don't have time to talk about 1 Corinthians, but this really underlies a lot of 1 Corinthians. When these guys are saying all things are permissible to me, they're only saying that because they're elite, and if they're elite, they can do whatever they want. It sounds like our culture. Elite social groups, what does it mean? They can do whatever they want with their lives and their money. They just live this incredibly self-indulgent thing. Why? Because it's what it means to be in my social position. Right? He will rarely undertake anything. Why? Because you're not so involved in this world around you, right? You don't want to do that. You kind of appear a bit aloof, right? But if he does, it will be something great and glorious. No sweeping the floors of the kitchen for this guy. His wife better not expect him to wash the dishes. That just ain't going to happen. Right? Only great stuff. He'll live his own life uninfluenced by anybody. To be influenced by others is to say, I am not self-sufficient. That's a sign of weakness. He will sometimes discuss things with close friends, right? But he wants to be very careful, because if he allows influence, it shows that he's compliant and not self-sufficient. Ancient world. Pinnacle of all of this is, of course, Caesar. He's a savior who brought war to an end and set all things in peaceful order. And since with his appearance, Caesar exceeded the hopes of all those who had received glad tidings before us. That's the word for gospel, by the way. Surpassing those who have been benefactors before him, that's looking past in the past, and leaving no hope of surpassing him in the future. He is the beginning of the gospel for the world. And it's the birthday of the god, namely Augustus. Wow. I think some of you see your presidents like this occasionally, and no human being can ever live up to it. Nor should they. So there he is. This is an inscription from Asia Minor. Since the eternal and deathless nature of the universe, this is probably the Logos, has perfected its immense benefits to mankind, in whom? In moi. Right. Granting us a supreme benefit for our happiness and welfare, Caesar Augustus, father of his own fatherland, divine Rome, Zeus paternal, and savior of the whole human race. That's what glory means in the ancient world. Notice the smooth chest, the eagle, the victor's crown on his head. We have arrived. Well, John tells a slightly different story. Whoops, 5 minutes. Okay. How does Jesus reveal his glory in John? Turns water into wine at a little village wedding. Can't quite imagine Caesar doing that. Not in Cana, some little bump on the outskirts of who knows where. Right? In the Greek world, the most commonly represented figure is this guy, Dionysus, the god of ecstasy. It's one of the reasons you enjoy wine. It gets you away from the crushing brokenness of the world around you for a few minutes. Ecstasy. He's also a god that calls into question the sufficiency of reason. A wonderful Greek play about this, Euripides, the Bacchae. He talks about Dionysus coming in disguise to Thebes, and the king of Thebes is a just committed rationalist. And he won't actually give any respect to ecstasy. Everything's rationality. Right? So Dionysus goes off into the forest and the wildness, which is where he lives, you know, where the wild things are. Okay? And who goes with him? The women, of course, because that's what they're all about. Right? Women are kind of this uncontrollable wildness. Right? So they kind of all go off with Dionysus because they're kind of getting all this kind of, oh, stuff. Oh, okay, whatever. So they go off with Dionysus. And the king of Thebes, you know, he's just a rationalist, but he decides to sneak out and see what's going on. And he goes out there, and his mother's there, and she's just in this ecstatic celebration of Dionysus, and some of it can be pretty crude and pretty violent, right? Including ritual murder, all kinds of phallic symbolism. I mean, it gets really weird and wild in some places. Right? And, you know, we're adults. You know what sexual climax is like, right? Pretty wild, isn't it? Well, you don't know. You've never experienced that, I know. Only people who are married. I understand that. Yeah, okay. Well, it's something to look forward to, right? Yeah. Now, you see, our God made that, you understand. Right? He created that. That's got to say something about God's approach to ecstasy. Now, I'm a charismatic. I don't have too much trouble with ecstasy. Okay? I can handle that. I can handle pre-meetings that go for 3 hours and you think you've only been at it for 15 minutes. I can handle that. Yes, you might think I'm just an arch-rationalist. No, not entirely. There's another part of my history that you know nothing about. Well, what you've got in Jesus is the combination of both. He is the embodiment of wisdom, but not to the denial of ecstasy. And what happens is when the king of Thebes goes out to spy on this orgiastic, ecstatic rite, his mother, so caught up in this, discovers his disguise. He's a guy he shouldn't be there, and they tear him limb from limb, and she goes back to the city, still in this kind of ecstasy, with her son's head in her arms, not realizing that's what she's done. There's a big debate about what Euripides is saying, but one argument is he's actually saying, you rationalists, you better watch out, because ecstasy will not be denied. And if you have no place for it, it is going to come around and bite you in a very tender spot. Right? You've got to have room for this. And John's telling you have both. That's why he uses the image of wine and not fruit juice. It's wine because of the ecstatic element involved in this. Right? That encounter with the presence of God that goes beyond rational articulation. We need it. I know a lot of Christians whose relationship to God, when you talk about it, is just hard work, dust and ashes. And they've never really experienced the all-surpassing joy of being lost in the presence of God, swept up in wonder and delight. Right? Never experienced that. That's a tragedy. And I think it's partly because of the way we do our theology. Right? We've done it so much like this. We have no room for the ecstatic. Jesus ties the two together. Right? So, water into wine. That's his glory. That's what our God is like. That's his reputation. Why don't people believe in Jesus? John tells us because they seek glory from one another. They don't seek the glory that comes from God. Right? So even the Jewish guys are behaving just like the Greek leaders, Greek people in their world, and then over against the pursuit of this kind of thing is, we talked about this, only the Father has life in himself and the Son has life. It's the great glory of God. And the wine becomes a symbol of the ecstatic life of the Spirit. The Torah is seen as water, dishwater, water for ritual washing, and Jesus turns that into the wine of the Spirit. If you have too much, you will get drunk, which is why the guy says, man, you should have served this first. So anyone's just kind of a little bit merry, serve the rubbish and nobody would know. How do you feel about that? Ooh, not so sure, right? Well, you jolly evangelicals, there might just be a little room for some. That's okay. I joke. Right, so here's a shepherd who lays down his life for his sheep. How different from Caesar? Right. He risks his life for Lazarus. It's not what Caesar does. Caesar murders hundreds of patrician leaders to get their money. Augustus Caesar, he's a real mongrel, not a nice person at all. Jesus is very, very different. So as you track through John's gospel, we've seen the glory of Jesus. You come toward the end, and we are almost at the end here. Right? He raises Lazarus. There's this entry into the city. The Pharisees go, what can we do? The whole world has gone after him. Yay. Right? Of course, John's writing this in Ephesus. Ephesus, long way from Jerusalem, center of the Greco-Roman cultural world, and there is a massive church. The whole world is going after this God who's unlike any God they have ever seen. And just as that's about to happen, some Greeks turn up. This is one of those enormous moments in the gospel. I get very excited when I come across this because these are my people, me not being Jewish, right? How did they hear about this? We have no idea. It's a little snippet. Jesus is there for Passover, and these guys turn up and approach some of the disciples, and, you know, sirs, we would see Jesus. And they're Greeks. Isn't that incredible? How did they hear about him? What was going on? We don't know. It's just one of those little kind of, man, I wish I had my TARDIS, Doctor Who, and go back and see what was going on there. But can't do it. Well, look at what Jesus says now. Now my soul is troubled, and what should I say? Father, save me from this hour? No, it is for this reason I have come to this hour. Father, glorify appearance, splendor, reputation, common opinion. Glorify your name. And then a voice came from heaven. I have glorified it and I will glorify it again. And where does that take us immediately after? To the Last Supper, which is about what we're going to celebrate this morning. So we're actually coming in 2009 and somewhere around 31, 33 AD to the same point in time. Right? We're about to reenact something that we are just going to discuss right now. It's Passover, Israel's great founding moment when God came and revealed his glory to them. And you remember John's prologue. The word became flesh and dwelt. Actually, the Greek word is tabernacled, tented. You need to hear that because where have you seen that before? In the Exodus, when God came and dwelt in the tabernacle among his people. This is not a God who is far from us. This is not a God that's ineffable and hard to find. This is not a God that can only be known by the elite. This is a God who comes among us and tents among Israel, a group of former slaves and a whole mixed multitude of other people from other nations who, when they saw this God at work, said, we want to serve him, and they came out with Israel. The beginning of a new international humanity. That's what this remembers. Now, in the ancient world, meals are very important. Right? Socrates is about to die. There he is, finger raised, okay? What's he doing? When you're about to die, it's amazing how well that focuses the mind. And it's often when leaders really leave what they think is the core and the heart of their message. Right? That's what Socrates did. People know that. When you're set up in a story and you're getting this is the last meal, you're waiting for it because you know that what you're going to get now is the guts, pardon me, is the center of what this person's all been on about. So you know that. It's like you're watching a movie. You know how the movie genres work. It's building to the climax. First century readers go, wow, this is it. We're really going to see what this whole thing is on about now. Right? What lies at the very heart of this God that is unlike any other? And for the first time in John's gospel, you get to meet the beloved disciple. It's the first time the name is mentioned. And what's he doing? Leaning on Jesus' heart. And if you're reading it in Greek as they would be, you'd recognize I have seen this word only once before in the gospel. And it's right back at the beginning where it says, no one has seen the Father, but the only begotten Son. This one has made him known. This one has come from the heart of the Father. Right? Only two times that word appears. Jesus comes from the heart, right? And at the very climactic moment in the story when you're expecting everything to be unveiled, you meet for the first time the beloved disciple, the one whose job it is to kind of reveal the very heart of what Jesus is on about and what's he doing. He's leaning with his head on Jesus' heart. Can you see the connections? Right. You are going to get this from the guy that Jesus chose to be his interpreter. Right. And what do you get? What happens next? The glory that I had from the beginning. Doesn't look a lot like Caesar, does it? You understand what's going on? A wash basin and a serving towel. Can you get any further from the Greek ideas of glory, isolated, self-serving, self-interested splendor? Can you get any further from a life where everything is calculated to improve my standing, to secure my existence, where it's all about making sure I get the right relationships, right, so that I become seen as a great one? You've got all that stuff happening, and this is being written to Ephesus, right? This is a hard kind of cultural heart of the Greco-Roman world. People know about all that glory stuff. And the highlight is Jesus comes out. He doesn't say anything. He comes out with a basin and a wash towel. Right? Interesting that that's not so central to our celebration. That is in some churches. You ever had somebody wash your feet? It's one of the most embarrassing and vulnerable things that can happen. For most of us, our feet are not usually the most attractive part of our being. But, you know, to have your feet washed by somebody is actually quite vulnerable. And I wonder what Judas thinks about this. We're not told why Judas betrays Jesus. But these disciples, they've heard Jesus preach about the kingdom of God. They probably have their own idea of what that means. Some of them think that means when Jesus comes into his kingdom, they're going to reign on his right and his left hand. In fact, they ask for this. They decide to have a one-up on their mates, right? So when their mates are kind of sitting down at the chow table, these two sneak quietly out and catch Jesus and say, "Hey, we want you to do whatever we ask you to." Sounds a bit like the health and wealth gospel, doesn't it? We want you to do whatever I ask you to. And their idea is we're going to sit in his right hand and his left hand. And I don't know what's in Judas, but you could just, like, what? The air's humming with excitement. What's he going to say? What's he going to do? These are final words now before he dies. He's going to get the heart of all of this. And he comes out with a flaming wasp. I mean, what in the world is this on about? This is not right. This is not even wrong. This is so far out of the universe. Right? And with all the passion within him, I just, you know, just deep, deep offense at this. You can see why, because it's just not how the world is put together. But this is exactly how the prince of this world is going to be cast out, because this is a God unlike any other. We will never change the world by marching to its drum. This is a different kind of story. This is how the prince of this world is going to be cast out. Doesn't look a lot like Caesar, does it? Nothing too splendid and glorious here. But I think there's a deep mystery. During that last meal, he says, So now, Father, glorify me in your own presence with the glory that I had in your presence before the world existed. Now, what was that glory? Resurrection glory? Jesus as a divine Caesar? Right. Is that what that glory was? Kind of the way you tend to go, right? Well, of course, it's going to be when he's vindicated and up there and all the rest of it. That's going to be the glory he had from the beginning, right? But I happen to think this same John also wrote the book of Revelation, and in the middle of that book, when Rome emerges as this horrible beast, you get this interesting little saying about people whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life, and it talks about the Lamb that was slain from the foundation of the world. what if this is the glory of our God? That the cross is not plan B, but the cross has been a part of him from the very beginning. And his act of creating the world was a willing embrace of the cross. And what if that's what John's trying to tell us? That the God you see broken and bloodied on a cross, that's actually the great glory of our God. That's his reputation. That's his splendor. This is a God who is so committed to giving you life that he will do this. This is the doxa, and this is the common opinion John wants us to have among ourselves. If we want to be agents of the life of this God, and he's the only God who has life, then this needs to be our common opinion. This needs to be the thing upon which our communities are built. It's a different story, but it's the only thing that's going to end up changing the world, it seems to me. So listen to Paul. But we have this treasure in clay jars, so that it may be made clear that this extraordinary power, this transforming power that changes life, culture, and brings empires to their knees, belongs to God and not to us. He's a different kind of God. We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed. Perplexed, but not driven to despair. Persecuted, but not forsaken. Struck down, but not destroyed. Always carrying in the body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be made visible in our bodies. For while we live, we are always being given up to death for Jesus' sake, so that the life of Jesus may be made visible in our mortal flesh. So death is at work in us, but life in you. This is the truth. This is holiness. And this is true glory. And it opens up a whole new world. Amen.